You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
So we're going to finish out this hour thinking about the presidential campaign, but we're going to step away from the GOP race down in Florida, where they're spending time in cheesy diners, maybe some coffee shops, shopping malls here and there, standing on those slick-looking stages, made-for-television events. What if you could launch your presidential campaign, not at some shopping mall or at some photo op staged event with a paid brass band and expensive catering out, but in the august halls of Congress itself, in a primetime speech that half of America is certain to watch at an event which not only costs your campaign nothing, but is actually mandated in the U.S. Constitution. Ooh, such are the advantages of incumbency. That every decade or so, there is the opportunity for a sitting president to essentially launch a campaign for a second term with every member of the opposing party politely in attendance. That's right, the State of the Union speech becomes the stump of the nation address. And we've got one tonight. Joining us to look at the State of the Union as a primetime electioneering speech is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He has a new book coming out called Governing America. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
So how does the State of the Union address change when it is this sort of launch speech for a president looking for a second term?
Well, the nation is watching the president give the speech, trying to decide if they're going to reelect him. So de facto, it's a different kind of setting. And the president realizes that he has an opportunity to start laying out an argument to contrast with what his opponents are saying in their primaries and caucuses. So it's impossible to escape the political nature of this State of the Union address.
Let's take a look at some State of the Union addresses of sitting presidents who were looking forward to either re-election or to trying to convince the American people to give them a second term. Here's Ronald Reagan back in 1984.
People of the Soviet, President Dwight Eisenhower, who fought by your side in World War II, said the essential struggle is not merely man against man or nation against nation. It is man against war.
Now, I can remember him. You know, he's not going to get any votes in Russia, right, or in the Soviet Union, but he's speaking to the world in the State of the Union address, and that had real electoral repercussions back in 1984.
That was a huge speech. Reagan had spent the first 4 years being very bellicose and using aggressive language against the Soviet Union. But by 1983 and then 84, he's mellowed. He's worried about the potential for nuclear war with the Soviets. And his advisors are saying you have to show that you're genuinely interested in peace or you're going to scare away voters. So he makes a dramatic set of statements in that speech where he reaches out to the Soviet Union. He says, you know, our sons and daughters have never fought each other in war, even though we have our differences. And he starts to open the doors to the potential for dialogue. And that will define much of his second term.
And of course, that was something that, you know, Walter Mondale couldn't do as the candidate opposing him, although he wasn't the nominee at that time. But no Democrat who wasn't the president could speak directly to the Soviet Union. We should remind ourselves that 1984 was the middle of a recession. And here's Ronald Reagan once again addressing the economy.
Americans build the future. And our vision of a better life for farmers, merchants and working people from the Americas to Asia begins with a simple premise. The future is best decided by ballots, not bullets.
Of course, weaving in this sort of peace stand with a view of the economy. What do you make of that?
Well, the rest of the speech also, he catalogs how much better things are than in 1980. It's very powerful. He has specific information where he contrasts where Americans were in 80 compared to 1984, and he sets up the theme of his campaign, Morning in America, again, that there has been an economic renewal and the country is starting to move forward. That will obviously be a little more difficult for President Obama tonight, but it was a very important part of that 1984 address.
And the theme of mourning in America is a theme that's been picked up by GOP candidates ever since. Let's look, thinking about Obama, and I don't want to draw a literal comparison between Barack Obama and Jimmy Carter, but you hear in 1980 Jimmy Carter almost pleading with Americans, acknowledging the difficulty of his years as president. Here's Jimmy Carter.
This last few months has not been an easy time for any of us. As we meet tonight, it has never been more clear that the state of our union depends on the state of the world.
Describe that speech in the midst of essentially a number of crises.
Well, that speech comes after the Soviets have invaded Afghanistan and, you know, posed a severe blow to Jimmy Carter's efforts for detente to reach an assault agreement with the Soviet Union. There are hostages being held in Iran. We've gone through a second oil crisis and the economy is still in shambles. So everything is going badly. And Jimmy Carter, in Carter-like fashion, is brutally honest. And it's a crisis-laden State of the Union address where at best you see a commander-in-chief, but at worst you see a president who is facing an onslaught of problems and doesn't really give a solution outwards. And so in some ways, that State of the Union was great for Ronald Reagan. It set up his arguments rather than Jimmy Carter's.
Let's listen to the Carter rhetoric again and come back to this point.
The 1980s have been born in turmoil, strife, and change. This is a time of challenge to our interests and our values. And it's a time to test our wisdom and our skills.
Now, he may be correct that it tests our wisdom and our skills, but it is neither wise nor skillful as a campaigner to use that kind of rhetoric. Is that correct?
It's a very difficult thing to do well, and he didn't do it well. In the end, you know, American voters do want a certain degree of hope, or what they're looking for in this final State of the Union address for someone seeking re-election is what comes next. How do we move forward? And Carter, who was brutally honest, didn't give that. Instead, he gave a frank assessment of where the country is. And so I think, you know, that's part of the challenge for the president, even in difficult times, to show the country where he can take them or she can take them.
And the last time a Democrat was a sitting president looking forward to a second term or making the argument for a second term was, of course, Bill Clinton. This is from 1996.
The era of big government is over.
And that was a theme, kind of a Morning in America theme from Clinton. Let's listen to a little more of his argument there.
We know big government does not have all the answers. We know there's not a program for every problem.
Talk about that speech, Julian Zelizer.
Well, that comes in the context of Republicans having retaken control of Congress in 1994. Newt Gingrich, of course, is the speaker. And there's a sense that there's been a Republican counter-revolution to his administration. And so what Clinton does, which is probably very smart politically, he starts this speech with the famous phrase, "The era of big government is over." He embraces the Republican message. He almost co-opts what they're saying. "I agree with you on the fundamentals." And then what he does is he starts to shift to a laundry list of smaller policies that he's going to pursue, like the V-chip to protect children from what they watch. And he goes through a whole set of these policies. So on the one hand, he says, "I agree with you. There is no big difference between myself and the Republicans." But then he tries to lay out what Bill Clinton's presidency will be about in the final year and obviously in the next 4 years if he's reelected.
And of course, he won big. You know, Bill Clinton did in 1996. We're talking with Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. His new book is called Governing America. Before we go, I mean, I remember that Clinton speech, and it was marked for the bigness of the rhetoric, but the smallness of those policies. I think you talk about seatbelts in that speech as well in 1996. Is there something unseemly about possibly using the State of the Union address, which is enshrined in the Constitution, to be a political stump speech?
I don't know. It seems to be downright American, to be honest. I don't think you can disentangle politics and policy in any year of a presidency. And the final State of the Union address, it's just impossible to shield it from the political environment in which it takes place. So all the presidents do it, certainly in the year of television, and I think it's going to continue. So it might be unseemly, but it's normal, and that's what we should expect.
And the model for Barack Obama tonight, Reagan, Carter, or Clinton?
I think he'd like to be Reagan, but I think realistically it's more Clinton right now. He's going to co-opt a little in terms of deficit reduction and coming back to those themes, but then he's going to try to lay out in small terms, in pragmatic fashion, what he would do to get this economy moving again. So my guess is he's aiming for Clinton. He wants to avoid Carter, and obviously he has ambitions to be like that Reagan speech.
Or even FDR, who gave more sitting State of the Union addresses than any other president in history. The address is tonight before a joint session of Congress at 9 o'clock Eastern Time. Jillian Zelizer will be watching, as will I, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
So our listeners have been calling and writing to say what they'd like to hear from the president tonight or what they'd say if they were giving the address. Paul from New Jersey texted, "I hope he breaks with the banksters and declares he will be his own man. I don't need to hear a thing from him. I'm certain he will continue to do everything possible to help the middle and lower classes. And public transportation and transit-oriented development is the only way to foster a healthy, growing, and sustainable economy." We always want to hear what you have to say. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. Celeste is out this week. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.